Welcome to Soundprint. I'm Larry Massett. What's the worst thing you've ever done? Think of something both illegal and immoral. Just hold the thought while I attempt to read your mind. I haven't got the faintest idea what you're thinking about, but I believe I can guess what you're not thinking. Odds are, you are not right now saying to yourself, "Gosh, what really bothers me is when I killed those half dozen hitchhikers and chopped their bodies in little pieces and buried them out in the desert. Bummer." I hazard this guess with some degree of assurance because serial killers are extremely rare. We are fascinated by them for the same reasons we take an interest in tornadoes, sharks, train wrecks. It's the charm of the horrible. But also, I think, we wonder, are these killers just like us, only more so, or are they truly fundamentally different? Our show today, from producer William Drummond, is called Falling in Death. Helen Morrison's Two Decades with Serial Killers.
No man is truly innocent. We all have transgressed in some way in our lives. And as I say, I've been impolite, and there are things I regret having done in my life. Very, very angry and indignant. I don't like being locked up for something I didn't do, and I don't like my liberty taken away, and I don't like being treated like an animal, and I don't like people walking around and ogling me like I'm some sort of weirdo, because I'm not. I'm perfectly happy with the person I am, and I've always been.
Convicted murderer Ted Bundy gave that interview from his jail cell in Glenwood Springs, Colorado in 1978. A little more than 10 years afterward, the state of Florida executed Bundy for the murder of a young woman in Lake City. He was also convicted in a Miami trial of murdering three female Florida state students. In addition, Bundy was linked to dozens of other murders of women across the country. Police and psychologists have coined a term for men like Bundy, serial killers. These are people who commit murders over a period of time, usually one victim at a time, for no apparent reason, not for robbery or revenge or jealousy, but for the thrill of killing.
Look at him, Starling. Tell me what you see.
Oh, he's a white male. Serial killers tend to hunt within their own ethnic groups. He's not a drifter. He's got his own house somewhere, not an apartment.
Why?
What he does with them takes privacy. He's in his 30s or 40s. He's got real physical strength combined with an older man's self-control. He's cautious, precise, and he's never impulsive. He'll never stop.
The movie Silence of the Lambs enjoyed great popularity and brought the serial killer topic out of the police station and squarely into public awareness, concern, and fear. A stereotype has grown up in popular culture, but these impressions are not based on first-hand knowledge. Although Ted Bundy was good-looking, self-confident, and charming, serial killers come in all sizes, shapes, and fetishes. But thanks to 25 years of research by a child psychiatrist in Chicago, more is now known about the patterns of behavior of this peculiar class of criminals. However, as more information comes to light, the question of what to do about the serial murderers only gets more and more complicated. Helen Morrison's specialty is child psychiatry. She's director of a group practice called the Evaluation Center, where psychiatrists work in diverse areas, ranging from cocaine addiction to the insanity defense in criminal cases. She's board certified in child and adolescent psychiatry, general psychiatry, and forensic psychiatry.
It's a painting of a sailboat on the water at sunset. On the surface, if you look at the sailboat, it looks okay. But when you really
Morrison is displaying an artwork in her office. The painting is not much as artworks go, but it is distinctive. It was done by John Wayne Gacy, the notorious Chicago killer who was convicted of murdering more than 30 young men and burying their remains in a crawl space under his house. Morrison acquired the painting in pursuit of a grim sideline to her sedate child psychiatry practice. For two decades, Helen Morrison has been keeping company regularly and intensively with serial killers.
The man charged with sexually assaulting and killing 33 young men and boys goes on trial today in Chicago. John Wayne Gacy is accused of luring the youths to a Chicago suburban home where he raped, killed, and buried them.
At a little past 7 this morning, 2,000 volts of electricity surged through Ted Bundy's body, and he was pronounced dead. The young man to Dahmer's apartment, believing Dahmer's version of the story that the young male was 19 years old and Dahmer's homosexual lover. The young man turned out to be a 14-year-old Laotian boy who Dahmer admitted to police he murdered minutes later. Outrage within the community boiled.
Most of the serial murderers cannot tell you when the person becomes dead. They will not know or not be able to tell you when the person died.
In fact, they often will talk to the corpses.
Oh, yes, yes, and it's very interesting because to them, they're just things that are there, and they'll talk to them. You know, do this, do that, don't sit like this, don't sit like that, come on, let's move over here.
Not knowing what's dead from what's alive represents a complete absence of even the most elementary level of human emotional instinct. And that's what Morrison says is the dominant characteristic of the serial killer. Morrison has devoted much of her adult life to understanding the whole phenomenon. At age 53, she says she has logged an average of 400 hours each in conversations with 42 captured serial murderers. Out of all of this firsthand experience, she has published relatively little in scientific journals. But her reputation has been spread widely, mainly through her frequent appearances at professional conferences and in the news media. Despite her imposing credentials, her insights tend to be more experiential than scientific. Few pure researchers would be as plain-spoken in their views as is Helen Morrison.
I've learned that these people are basically, they're worse than an animal. They're less than a human being, but I don't know what they are. I know that all the time that you could spend in the world, there's nothing you can do therapy with in these individuals, because you need some basic structure to do some therapy. We have to make up our mind as both a scientific community, a professional community, and a lay community as to what we want to do with these people. We can't just close the door. And yes, we'd like to forget about them, we'd like to forget about their crimes, but that's not going to help us stop the next one who's going to be coming down the road. And there always is a next one.
Morrison has not yet written the definitive article on what makes the serial murderer tick, and some of her professional colleagues criticize her lack of publication credits. But professional glory never seemed to be Morrison's aim. Her true motivation for pursuing serial killers is frankly puzzling. Almost from the beginning, Morrison was like the Jessica Fletcher character from TV's Murder, She Wrote, a wealthy, refined woman who was ineluctably attracted to homicide. In Morrison's case, the grislier the better. Morrison's voyage of discovery began when she was a resident in psychiatry at the University of Wisconsin, and she got a call from an FBI special agent asking her to visit Wisconsin's Central State Hospital for the criminally insane. There she met the first in her long line of killer confidants. It was Richard Masick, and he had been appropriately dubbed the Mad Biter by the newspapers because of his penchant for leaving teeth marks on the buttocks of the corpses of his dozen or so victims.
I worked with Masick for about between 400 and 600 hours, and fortunately he was the first person that I could interview, and I could concentrate on him. I could concentrate on his interviews. And it was during the interviews with Richard Masick that the process of the scientific look at what could possibly underlie this type of violence started to be formed.
For Helen Morrison, Richard Masick became the archetype for her study of this group of killers. In him, she first glimpsed the fact that human emotions were conspicuously absent.
He found his victims in hotels, maids in hotels. He found his victims in laundromats. He would go into the laundromats late at night when there would be one or two people or one person there. He would meet them in singles bars. But it was always a certain person, a certain type of person, a certain characteristic of a person. I'm not just talking about hair, but something that emotionally that I call falling in death. It's like seeing someone across a crowded room and saying, that's the person I'm going to kill next.
The face-to-face setting in the prison cell gave Morrison long, unbroken periods of exposure to those thought processes. In March 1977, Morrison was doggedly pressing Masick for details about five unsolved homicides in Illinois, details the killer either would not or could not recall. These conversations are brought to life here by actors portraying the psychiatrist Helen Morrison and the killer Richard Masick, based on the transcripts of the interviews.
I remember one statement and a remark you made to me at our last meeting, that you can see my build, that I have power. I don't know if that was meant to flatter me or what, but my power and strength scares me at times. I don't display it or show off with it. I'm on this earth to impress nobody. I'm here just like anybody else. I just happen to be the way I am. I love life, people, children, animals, beauty. But why? Why do I destroy them? What causes me to kill, hurt? I am so ashamed. I'm very tired now. Exhausted. Excuse me for now.
Richard, I know there's something really building, and I'd like to ask you some specific questions, okay?
Okay. Make sure the tape won't run out.
The hundreds of hours of interview are, for the most part, small talk. Morrison is the first to admit that her biggest job was fighting boredom, because, as she soon learned, serial killers are egocentric and often deliver long, numbing soliloquies. She was expected to be the straight man, the sounding board. To the serial killer, everybody is there to serve his purposes. Sometimes the encounters became highly charged verbal fencing matches, as Masick would alternately want to be reassured, challenged, or stroked.
Remember when I said to you last week that I thought you were very powerful and that I could tell you had a great deal of power? You said that you didn't know whether it was supposed to flatter you. That's not what I had in mind at all. You know, for me, it was a statement of fact, because I don't go around flattering people. I can't.
Some women will say it as to flatter a man. You know, flattery to make them feel more muscular or more manlier. That's the same as a man will flatter a woman by her apparel, or her makeup, or her hair, or the way she walks, and so forth and so on. So when you mentioned that, I was wondering if you were looking for an expression at the time you said it, like would I smile ear to ear? Or would I twinkle in my eye?
You mean, was I trying to get to you?
No, just for an expression. Trying to see. I would sort of say trying to psych you in the same way you were trying to psych me.
Every move Masick made and his every word were a part of a strategy to obtain a goal. He would posture in one way and then the other. He would fake ignorance or stage a mock confession when caught in a contradiction.
Can I repeat a question you asked?
Go ahead. I mean anything.
Okay. You said, I love life, people, children, animals, and beauty. But why? Why do I destroy them? What causes me to kill, hurt?
It's the complete opposite of what I believe.
I know. The paradox.
Well, I don't know what that is, but...
Complete opposite.
It's the complete opposite. Why? All my offenses... They've been sex offenses, going back to grade school. Peeping Tom, stealing women's clothing off of the clotheslines, bras, panties, nylons. That stabbing incident in 1967. I didn't even know the girl. What caused it? I don't know. Why? I didn't want to hurt anybody.
But Masick's revelations were lacking any genuine sense of guilt. As he pretended to bare his soul, he wanted simply to win sympathy and support from Dr. Morrison, whom he saw as an ally. But she came away from these long, tense conversations convinced of one thing. Richard Masick had no more regard for her as a person or a human being than he did for any piece of furniture in the room. He tolerated her only as long as he felt that she was useful to him. Occasionally, he would use his cunning to toy with her, employing what she calls a sadistic use of knowledge.
One of the August nights that I happened to be having worked with him, I had to stay at a motel that was about 15 miles away from this small country jail. And driving back after a very, very difficult day, and I get back to the motel, and I go up to the second floor, and it's something out of, you know, a little frame place, and the telephone rings. And I answer the phone, and it says, hi, this is Richie. But saying, well, you know, all you have to do is to look out your window, because if you look out your window, there's a lighted phone booth down on the corner. And if you come to the window and look down, I'm standing there. I'm using that telephone booth.
I did 4 years and about 7 months in the penitentiary in Illinois. Recommendations were I should go to a hospital. There was the rape charge, what I'm here for now. But I beat that woman, and I had sex with her. The other one is the Abbey Bar. I didn't beat her, but I choked her with a towel. She went unconscious. And then I took her into the bedroom parlor room. I placed her on the bed, removed her clothes. I tried to have sex, and I couldn't. Attention. And the frustrations. And the sweat. And I was feeling very uncomfortable. I got myself back together, and I left out of the room. I got to my car, and I put my hands in my pockets to get the keys, and I pulled out the knife, and I looked at it. It was closed, but it had blood on it. But it wasn't my blood. I don't know. I can't recall a point. Is it her blood?
Masick was either unwilling or unable to recall specific details of the killings. And in this regard, he was like many of the other killers in Morrison's experience. He could swing suddenly from a benevolent mood in which he seemed at peace with himself to behaving like a caged and desperate animal. The question of the 5 unsolved murders in Illinois troubled Richard Masick. He did not want to go to Illinois to face charges. Masick looked to Dr. Morrison to provide him with a possible defense.
I've got to know who else they might try, because when I go to Illinois, they're going to start in on this thing, and then they're going to drum me on the other 3 until they get an answer.
Can we do something here to avoid that?
I don't know.
I think, Richard, I believe it's someplace in your head.
What is a brain scan? An EEG?
Yeah, okay. What that is a brainwave test. It measures the electrical activity in the brain. And I can tell you, generally, it's used with kids who have epilepsy. Why did you ask?
Could I benefit by something like that?
Doesn't sound like you've had any history of that.
As it is, my thinking is screwed up. It all comes from here in my head. Whatever I do, it all comes from here.
No, wait a minute. You're pushing yourself. What I'm wondering about is, if there were some physical kind of reason for you to do this stuff, would that make it easier?
I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to say, would the EEG work on a principle like an EKG for your heart to show you get the malfunction of a valve, a rupture, or whatever? Would that show that I have a malfunction of a certain part of my brain, or one of the electrical waves, or whatever it is, overload or underload, or it's not functioning, or whatever?
No.
You see, I know nothing. I'm no doctor.
With no ability to form emotional attachments, the serial killer strains the definition of human being. Morrison even speculates that serial killers could be a subspecies of humanity, and the act of murder makes them feel more human. In choosing and stalking a victim, the killer's personality steps to a higher level of performance. He has to play a role to be charming, to be friendly, to entice the victim. In engaging in this masquerade, the killer for a fleeting moment makes an emotional connection with another person. Unfortunately, the only person to witness the brief transformation of the killer rarely lives to tell about it.
They have really no psychological structure. They look like people, but they're not people. And the serial murderer seems to use his murders as a way of proving that something is real. These murders look as if the murderer is saying, oh, I know what to do here. I mean, if I pull this leg off, this is going to happen. If I pull that leg off, that's going to happen. Yes, I know this. I know I can function here in this way and in this place and in this time.
He sees no difference between an inanimate object and a living, breathing person. Morrison once asked Masick, Richie, am I dead or alive? He stared at her blankly, was momentarily at a loss, and said, alive, I guess. In trying to understand the forces inside the killers' minds that make them kill, Morrison also interviewed the parents of the murderers whenever they could be found. She says that in many cases, the mother has an obsessive concern with the child, and John Wayne Gacy's mother was no exception.
You ask a mother to describe how they and their child, the serial murderer, are similar, and they very frequently will tell you a story that borders on the psychic type or unexplained circumstances. One of the cases in which a mother said that, oh, he's just like me, and you say, well, can you explain to me how you see him being just like you? And the mother explains that, well, I had a tooth in one spot, and I went to sleep, and the next morning I woke up, and he had the tooth in the very same spot.
While maternal obsessiveness is typical, says Morrison, the common stereotype that the serial murderer was an abused child is without foundation. She also attacks the notion that the crimes are sexual. The killer, she says, never advances emotionally beyond infancy. In effect, the serial murderer lacks any sexual identity. Often, like Gacy, they are sexually undefined. Here is a man who had sex with young men, dozens of whom he killed and buried in his basement. But recreated here by an actor, Gacy is moralistic about sex and argues that he cares deeply about his second wife, Carol.
I got divorced in February of 76, but I continued to date my ex-wife to June of 78. I was interested in getting back with her. I wanted to get back with her, but she married in November of 78, and I just went to pieces. She got mixed up. She was working as a security guard at O'Hare Airport. Anyway, she'd gone out with some other guy from some limousine service thereabout. This guy wanted to take pictures of her in bed, but Carol's naive about sex. Carol's first husband was a real bastard animal with her, and when she married me, I was kind and gentle to her. My feeling and my belief is that in a sexual relationship with a female, it's the male's job to satisfy the female first and then satisfy your own. That's the way I always looked at it. So consequently, I treated Carol different. Whereas she described some of the things Charlie, her first husband, did, if he felt like having sex, he'd just grab her and put her down until he was satisfied. He'd joke about it. That was his attitude. He'd just bang her, and when he was done, if she didn't get her, the hell with it. But I still love Carol, believe it or not. I think we got divorced because of different kinds of crowds.
To understand Gacy and all the others, Morrison relies solely on her perspective of developmental psychology. Her tools are the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, or sometimes the Rorschach Inkblot Test. What she cannot do is peel back the skin and conduct tests that examine the physiology of the serial killer. Her suspicion is that it's at this biological level that many answers lie.
Is there something genetically? I mean, are these people born with a possibility of developing into a serial murderer? And is there something in the environment that acts upon that potential? But the problem that we have as researchers is that we're not permitted to become or to use invasive testing on prisoners. if I could get permission, implanting electrodes and doing deep brain recordings would be very, very important.
That permission is not likely to come because of the legal protections accorded the rights of even convicted murderers. She argues that there is somewhere down deep a biological blueprint to personality development, and genetic, neurological, and developmental factors interact below the surface to produce the serial killer. It's a moot point. She's not allowed even to take blood samples from serial killers, let alone engage in chromosome mapping or neurological examinations, even if the tests are administered post-mortem. Blocked off from biological answers, Morrison says less than one-third of the possible causes of the serial killer phenomenon can be studied, and thus medical science is left to ponder an enigma.
This is a completely different individual than we have ever seen before, and it's a completely different developmental process than we've seen before. I don't have an answer. I have a lot of observations. Down the road, 2, 3, 4 generations, maybe we'll have much more of a capability. But we're still going to be faced with the issues of the rights of the person who's accused, the rights of the victim, the rights of the families, and the justice system. I can't go in and put electrodes in a serial murderer's brain because then I should be able to do it to everybody. So there are so many issues to be resolved in that legal-medical interface that until those are resolved, we're not going to be able to really learn.
Falling in Death, Helen Morrison's 2 decades with serial killers, was produced by William Drummond, studio engineer Robin Wise, production assistant Joe Tamblin. The actors were the Shotgun Players of Berkeley, California. Special thanks to KUTV in Salt Lake City. Coming up next week on Soundprint, we turn your radio dial to Croatia for a report on certain recent events.
Tanks went from one house to another. One shell into the house, and then the Chetniks come to loot. Then they set the house on fire and throw a couple of grenades into the cellar where the old people are hiding.
Croatian Radio, a journal of war. Next week on Soundprint, and in 2 weeks we take you to the beaches of Normandy 50 years ago.
No one thought the enemy was going to give us this kind of opposition on the water's edge. This turned boys into men. Some would be very brave men, others would soon be dead men, but all those who survived would be frightened men. This is where the discipline and training took over.
D-Day Diary, coming up soon on Soundprint. Soundprint is technical producer Anna Maria de Freitas, studio engineer Robin Wise, and executive producer Moira Rankin. I'm Larry Massett. Write us with your ideas, comments, and suggestions. Write Soundprint, 2216 North Charles Street, Baltimore, Maryland, 21218. On the internet, our address is soundprint@jhu.edu. That's soundprint@jhu.edu. Cassettes are $12.50 to order by phone. Call 410-516-0833. That's 410-516-0833. Soundprint is produced with support from the National Endowment for the Arts. Additional support comes from this and other NPR member stations and the NPR Information Fund, whose contributors include the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation.